Coming up on Digital Music Trends 170, recorded on the 12th of February 2014, a roundup of 2013 recorded music revenues, the music industry and YouTube, the latest at Beats Music, Shuffler FM, Spotify's Times partnership, the latest on ASCAP and BMI's court battles, and much more. DMT's coverage is brought to you by CI, the delivery platform used by leading independent labels, distributors, and aggregators around the world, on ci-info.com. Hello everyone and welcome to Digital Music Trends. I'm Andrea Leonardi and this is the weekly show where we talk about and try to make sense of the latest news in the digital music industry. And DMT is available as an audio and a video show on a variety of channels, including the iTunes Store, most podcatching apps, including Downcast, YouTube, SoundCloud, Mixcloud, Spreaker, Stitcher, TuneIn Radio, and Audioboo. That's always a mouthful. And to get in touch with the show, you can tweet us on @DigiMusicTrends or email us on contact@DigitalMusicTrends.com. And as you've seen in the intro of this week's show, the podcast is brought to you this week by CI, the leading provider of digital delivery services to the independent community. So go and check them out on ci-info.com as they're helping us keep the lights on for this month. And it's a real pleasure to welcome back three guests, starting with Cristelia Garcia, visiting professor of law at George Washington University. So hi, Cristelia, and thanks for joining us. How's it going?
Hi, I'm very well, thanks. Thank you for having me.
It's a pleasure to have you back. And also, it's great to have Karim Fanouz back from Music Ally, where he's the head of research. So hi, Karim. How's it going?
Hey, Andrea. I'm great. Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
And of course, if you don't know about Music Ally, well, if you listen to this podcast, you really should. So go and check out musically.com for everything about the company. And also, they have a really great podcast as well that comes out weekly. And also, it's fantastic to welcome back after an incredibly long absence. I think it's like 8 weeks. It's like, wow, it's unbelievable. And Darren Hemmings, founder of digital marketing agency Motive Unknown. So hey, Darren, thanks for joining me.
Hello, good to be here. Sorry about the hat, but it's about -5 in my studio right now.
I know. I think myself, you know, Darren and Karim are all in London, and there's a horrible windstorm and rainstorm, some sort of sleet happening outside. So if we start blowing away in the middle of the show, then you know what's happened. And, you know, I was going to mention for Darren, actually, he also compiles a very handy daily digest on the latest news in music tech and digital marketing. So you can find that on motiveunknown.com. Go and sign up. It's a really great resource. And, you know, today we have a lot of ground to cover, and not all of it is going to be fun and games. And so I'm going to pretend like I'm doing the commentary of the snowboarding halfpipe. I know I'm not cool enough to do that, but you know I'm going to try and just make it super exciting because I'm going to start by talking about 2013 recorded music revenues from around the world. Mm-hmm. So you know, Italy and France's results came in last week and they were pretty positive. You know, Italy recorded a 4% rise in recorded music revenues, which is pretty impressive considering that Italy has been on a declining slope for quite a long time, and France recorded a 2.3% to rise as well. So that's good. Italy particularly had a good year on the digital front, up 18% with downloads up 6% and physical down only 5%, whilst France was more of a mixed bag because digital was only up 0.6% in terms of revenues, which is kind of odd, and the physical was actually up 1%, which was completely counterintuitive, but there you go. So surprisingly, in Europe, only the UK so far has posted a negative result with a -0.6%. Germany is up 1%, Sweden is up 5%, Norway is up 11%, and for the US, we don't really have figures yet, but we do know that overall music sales declined 6.3%, but streaming grew 32%. So you can take that with a pinch of salt. We're going to see the figures, the hard figures, when they come in later this year. So first of all, Darren, do you think that this is starting to shape into a trend for the industry? And, you know, do you think that this is the kind of numbers that the industry was hoping for at this point?
I think it's certainly shaping into a trend. I mean, you know, it'd be nice to have some positive stories around this where, you know, there's... 10 years plus of kind of stuff's gone down type reports.
Yeah.
So I think, you know, the positive responses are good. And I think they're good for the business as well, because I think when you get good, you know, good news like this kind of thing, then people respond positively and perhaps open up a bit more. They're not so defensive about the deals they're signing. Oh. And, you know, we might just start to see things use the phrase loosen up a bit. It sounds a bit flippant, but you know what I mean? As regards, you know, how much people are diving into new opportunities and things like that. I mean, we've seen, you know, even at MeetM, you know, there was sort of seems to be an even split between people being critical of certain new, you know, tech companies or, you know, new technologies themselves, and then others being quite keen to embrace. But, you know, hopefully stories like this will be good for business in that sense of, you know, of pushing a bit more of a positive mindset on things. And I think that'd be no bad thing, really, because I think we've had a very long period of, you know, rather negative talk around revenues and things in particular. So as regards whether it's what the music industry wanted to see, I'm not sure. But, you know, I don't sort of work closely enough within that sphere, you know, and I mean, I think independent labels don't see it that way, that, you know, it's, you know, they're looking at their own bottom line and they're worrying about themselves. So really the question is whether it's the sort of thing the majors would have wanted to see as the sort of biggest stakeholders in the industry, as it were. But obviously, I'm not close enough around that to really comment, but I would think it's good news. Yeah. I mean, the, you know, the improvements have to be good news, right? I mean, it's better than everything went down. So, yeah, I mean, you know, I think it's good, and I just hope that this will start a bit more of a sort of positive attitude that we'll see a bit more embracing of things and perhaps a bit less, you know, moaning and whining from certain quarters.
Yeah. So, and Karim, on your end, like, you deal with a lot of international, you know, developments at Musicala. You deal with a lot of different countries and territories and labels. So for you, what does this represent? Is it a move forward for the industry, or is it still a bit of a mixed bag in terms of signals right now?
I think it's a bit of both. And the most important lesson I've learned is to look at every territory from a local point of view as well. I mean, I think that it good news in that we had our first rise back in 2012 globally. So that was a small rise, you know, 0.2%, but it's still a rise. So there's a recovery going on there. Overall, I think the encouraging figure in this lot is the Italian market, which I know quite well. So to see the rise in streaming, and, you know, that's supporting a market which is traditionally very, very dogged by piracy, that's extremely encouraging, because the problem with the Italian market has always been a very, very bad piracy problem. So to see it recovering and digital driving that is great. So I think those are the two things for me.
There was also massive diffidence towards credit cards in Italy as well, which was a problem.
Yes, there was that problem there as well. So obviously the culture is changing slightly and coming in line with, you know, perhaps what's happening in the Nordics, which can only be good news in terms of digital and streaming driving the market forward.
Yeah, yeah, sure. And Cristelia, you keep an eye on the international scene as well. And, you know, both from an international standpoint and the US, do you think that the industry is on the right path at this point? And, you know, do you think that record labels, rights holders are starting to be more positive and happier about the results that streaming services, for example, are posting today?
Sure. Well, I think it depends on who you ask. I think that there are certainly some quarters who are expressing some optimism around the streaming model. I think the agreement among parties would probably be that it's not where they want it to be yet, but there are some people who are more hopeful that it will get there. And other people, maybe it's less that they're hopeful it'll get there and more that they're more accepting that this is the model that consumers want, and that if we want to stay in the game, we're going to need to find ways to work within the model that consumers have expressed a preference for. So I don't know so much that they're happy and they don't want to be selling CDs for $18.99, but I think they know that if consumers want this streaming service, they're going to need to get in the game and play with it. And we've been seeing, you know, the articles coming about people who have tried different windowing strategies and the types of artists that it works for and the types of artists who it actually can hurt, because they're not getting their music out when people are looking for it. And I think those kinds of stories themselves help to change attitudes around streaming a little bit.
Yeah, sure. And also in the last few months, we've seen a bit of a shift in attitude towards Spotify, for example. We've seen people shifting more of the blame on labels for distribution of royalties rather than on Spotify itself. So Cristelia, on your end, especially for older artists that are on older contracts, what chance do you think they have of renegotiating their royalty splits so that they get a better slice of the pie compared to the one that they get today, which is very similar to the kind of splits they get from the sort of heritage deals that had to do with the physical sales?
Right. Well, post post M&M, I think if they have decent counsel, they have a decent chance of coming back to the table and renegotiating for rights which they can argue were simply not contemplated at the time that the deals were originally signed. As you guys know, there's vague language to the effect of, you know, and other distributions in the future. But the argument post M&M is pretty clear that no one anticipated this particular type of streaming. And I'd say that the chances are pretty good. The parties I'd be more worried about are the new folks coming in who are, now that the labels know, they're putting very strict splits in there. And, you know, if you're a new artist and you're just trying to get the deal and get the advance, you can record the album, you may accept those terms where later you'll wish that you hadn't done those. So I think the older artists are actually probably in a slightly better position.
Yeah, absolutely. And there were a slew of articles actually this week that were quite interesting in the past sort of 8-10 days. I'll just do a quick rundown. For example, Helene Lindvall at The Guardian wrote a great piece focusing on the struggle of Swedish independent labels in spite of an apparent new golden age for recorded music revenues in Sweden. Daniel Norgard posted a Musical.ly, a really thorough, great piece that I'll link in on the show notes, talking about Norway's struggle in local market where Norwegian artists are losing market share to international ones via streaming services. And Mark Mulligan on his latest post talked about cannibalization coming from other sources that are not actually music industry sources, but from other entertainment sources. So, for example, people decided to spend their money on in-app purchases of games rather than on music when they're playing on their mobile devices. So there's a slew of different opinions out there as to you know, how the industry is doing from different perspectives, different size artists, labels, national, local approaches as well. So it's really difficult to navigate the space, right? It's becoming a bit of a headache. And Karim, on your end, from the Norwegian artist perspective, did you find that quite interesting? Like, I found that super interesting to see how the adoption of streaming services also shifted the market share of local artists and reduced it.
Yeah, I think that's been a problem that people have been worried about for a while, actually. So, which was, I was very interested to read Helene's article as well. And people I've been speaking to on the ground, you know, tell me that also when dealing with the streaming model, it's the kind of more niche local repertoire artists that really have the concerns because their per unit kind of revenue is completely turned on its head. So I think it's a very interesting problem, and you know, we can't afford to see that music disappear. I think the issues, there are a few issues. I think one of the biggest ones is it's an easy way out, but streaming has still not hit anything close to scale, and we're all waiting for that to happen, if and when it will happen, and in what form the models will be. You know, there's a big debate going on about mid-tier models now as well. So I think we just don't know enough, but there is a big concern about local and niche repertoire, which has to be addressed. I don't know exactly what the answer is at the moment, apart from the classic case of looking for different trickles from other revenue streams, you know, doing as much as you can with D2C to change things and capitalizing on the live market as well. Interestingly, one thing to react to in Helene's article, which I found... was the attack at Digster. So one of the indies had an attack at Digster and curation. Okay, and so perhaps indie and local artists could be doing much more in terms of curation. I mean, I know Digster, if I'm right, tell me if I'm right, I think it's curated mostly by Universal. Is that right? So of course there's going to be a problem there, but that's a reason why indies should jump up and try and give people better curated experiences. Personally, I really like, you know, the Domino app on Spotify as an example, and there are some other great ones. So people should be proactively doing as much as they can to get their music out there on these platforms. If they find problems with for example, Digster just pushing major label content.
Yeah, and Darren, that's kind of a weird thing that we're seeing right now, that on the one side, we're seeing independent content doing exceedingly well on streaming services, and also talking to Charles Caldas and Medium, they were talking about how amazing the market share for independent labels is on streaming services. On the other side, we also hear a lot of independent record labels talk about how little revenues they get from Spotify, and therefore it feels like those, you know, the benefit of having that exposure on streaming services is somehow negated by the revenues that come off it. So, you know, what do you think that they're going to end up standing right now? You know, do you hear, you know, working with independent labels, do you still hear mixed feelings about streaming right now?
I think you get some artists are anti.
Yeah.
I mean, I think, as I've said before on here, I think one problem you get is that, you know, the famous artist saying, you know, making negative remarks about anything really, but in this case, you know, streaming services and usually Spotify tends to be the thing that gets a lot of coverage, and you know, a lot of people write about that, and it gets, you know, it travels far and wide, and other artists pick all that up because it's a peer that's made those remarks. The problem is that when, you know, an arguably more informed person who isn't a famous rock star then sort of produces a counterpoint to that, it doesn't really get the coverage, and it doesn't tend to reach those artists. So yeah. In my experience, you see quite a lot of artists are often kind of filled with, you know, a degree of bad wisdom. And whenever I've had these conversations with artists, they're almost always sort of a bit misinformed.
Yeah. But on the label side, like, I think, you know, artists is it's kind of a difficult issue because it's a very personal issue. But when you're talking about hard hitting business numbers, money, I think like labels are probably a better barometer of what's happening here. You know, do you feel like they are now embracing streaming in spite of the kind of mismatching revenues right now? And I'm just hoping that, as Karim said, there's going to be volume eventually in sort of a year's time that's going to bring revenues in.
I have to be honest, you know, the labels that I have, you know, had any dealings with or just had conversations with over the last 12 months, damn near every one of them is really happy with the money they're getting back from Spotify. You know, they're actually, you know, it's becoming, I think it's probably safe to say that across the board, it's probably now becoming kind of like the number two revenue stream after iTunes. You know, and yes, there's a drop off. You know, it's not like it's literally nipping at the heels of your iTunes income, but, you know, they're all seeing that it counts for a surprising amount. And equally, I think the thing that a lot of them are raising their eyebrows on is then seeing what they get paid by YouTube, because that seems to have not really featured in this discussion. You know, everyone's so busy bashing Spotify and co that they seem to be totally missing that, you know, they got millions of views on YouTube and only got paid about a quarter or less of what they got from Spotify. So yeah. It's all relative, and it's kind of like, yes, against iTunes revenue, Spotify at first seemed pretty lame. Now it looks like, because of the volume of use and things like that, you know, and it's a pretty ballsy move that Spotify have made with the kind of free model now that's really kind of reducing those barriers to usage, you know, and adoption. So, yeah, I mean, I have to say most of the people I talk to, and I, you know, and to be clear, you know, I think indie is a very broad term, you know, there's, you know, Excel is an indie, Beggars are an indie, but they're massive, you know, they're really big. And then you get very, very small indies. But yeah, across the board, most of them that I, and it's only anecdotal, obviously, it's only the people I've talked to, but, they, you know, they have been very positive about it. And I think it probably doesn't, you know, it's quite sad that at the moment we're seeing this kind of lines of division that seem to be getting built up by someone. So it's like, if it's not Spotify, it's the labels, you know. It's like there's a million artists around the corner with, you know, pitchforks and flaming torches, yeah, all just looking for someone to lynch on this one. But yeah, talk to any label I know, and actually they're all pretty pleased with how it's going.
And talking about artists with pitchforks, Cristalia, I wanted to bring up Midem, and one of the key sort of hot spots of Midem in terms of the subjects was the relationship between the music industry and Google. And that was kind of interesting because it really raised some tempers in the room sometimes, you know, in some panels when Google was involved, artists calling into question the revenues coming from YouTube, calling into question Google's inaction when it comes to deranking sites that promote piracy, or deranking sites that allow you to rip YouTube videos as MP3s. So there are a lot of, you know, discussions around that, which you know, it made it kind of it showed that there is still a lot of tension between the two parties, essentially between YouTube, Google, and the music industry. So from your end, from a legal standpoint as well as a sort of a rights standpoint, how do you think that the relationship is going to progress? Do you think that at this point, you know, the cards are drawn and the industry has got, you know, has got the cards that it's got and it can't do much more on that front? Or do you think there is still some room for negotiation and for increasing those rates, not purely relating to volumes, but also to the rates themselves?
Right. I hope that there's still some room for negotiation. This is the the framing of this debate where it's technology versus artists, I think is really unfortunate. Yeah. And as we've been, you know, as I'm here in DC and I've been able to attend a lot of the copyright hearings that the subcommittee on IP holds, it's so marked that when the committee, for example, holds the hearings, as I think I've mentioned, they'll often have two separate days. So they'll have sort of the artist labels day. It's questionable whether they should even be doing it that way, but they'll have like the, you know, the content day one day and technology on a separate day, as if they're presenting entirely different, you know, positions, which they often are, but as if they're not, you know, talking about the same services. And I think I'm hopeful that there will be some room for movement, especially as there begins to be a little bit more of an acceptance and an embracing within the music industry that there is. That the future really lies with these technologies. At the same time, I think that Google and YouTube and other technologies of that sort that are emerging and that are working in the content space could do a much better job of recognizing the role that content plays in supporting their businesses. From the artists that I've talked to, you know, I'm working on this artist copyright project where I'm interviewing a bunch of different artists. From the folks I've spoken to, the biggest issue from artists, this isn't even labels, but artists themselves, is that they feel that this unfairness about not making money off the advertising that's being thrown around their content, right? So I think part of this has to do with Google and YouTube. Maybe they just need to make a more public recognition of the role that content's playing in building their business, and then make some, you know, substantive moves towards accommodating artists financially for the role that they're playing in this. So it may be the case that for UGC, they have some, you know, paltry rate, and that's fine for someone's toddler, you know, dancing around their house. But for the music videos, we need to see different rates and different payments and different structures and a recognition that this is a very different type of beast than UGC. This is, you know, content that costs money to make, and it should be compensated differently than content that someone filmed on their iPhone. And I think that's kind of the missing link. There's just this this assumption that the two parties are working against each other, which is a dangerous one, because I think there could be great things done between YouTube and the content world if they were able to sort of find common ground around the recognition that both of the parties are truly interdependent and one could not be running their business without the other.
Yeah, absolutely. Karim, anything to comment on that?
Yeah, a couple of things. I think I'm just talking of, you know, headline grabbing sort of numbers. I think the interesting thing was, wasn't it said that YouTube has paid nearly $1 billion to rights holders, and yeah, that's the same that Spotify is apparently approaching in markedly different ranges of time and also with massively different user bases. So it is interesting that that debate is now shifting to YouTube rather than the streaming services. And it's interesting also that Darren said for many people, streaming is now becoming the second digital revenue stream, sort of in front of YouTube. So there is a lot of tide change here, and I think the next few months are going to be really interesting. And I just wanted to add a couple of things to the indie debate as well. The services are trying. I think that's very important too. You know, Charles Caldas is very happy with the deal Merlin got with Beats. And I think that says a lot as well about how opinions are changing and attitudes are changing. And at the same time, Spotify, I think Billy Bragg is doing a radio show which is about uncovering obscure sort of tracks on Spotify. Yep. And there was a great app called Forgetify that came out the other day, which previews all of the tracks that, you know, nobody's really listened to on Spotify. So there's a lot happening there as well, which I think is important to consider. And one thing that's close to my heart, though, that's important to raise is that I think what really suffers in all of these foreign territories as well, and is important to be aware of, is it's the local language stuff, the more traditional local language repertoire that is losing that higher per unit revenue. That's, those stars of music are really heading into trouble, I think, and the rights holders and writers and performers are extremely worried. And I think that's something that for the moment maybe can only be propped up or helped by, you know, government bodies or agencies, and they need to be looked after while we're going through this transition. I think that's something that people don't think about. I know it's very specialist, but it's kind of close to my heart to think about that sort of stuff too. Yeah,
absolutely. That makes a heap of sense. And you know, talking about, you know, you mentioned Beats Music, and of course I guess everybody's happy with the deal that Beats Music is giving out because it's the same deal for everybody. So, I mean, that's kind of a groundbreaking thing as far as rates are concerned. But let's talk about that in a second. First of all, Darren, I want to ask you about the marketing side of things. The Beats rolled out an advert. We didn't manage to talk about it on the show because we had the Medium episode last week, and they rolled out an advert at the Super Bowl with Ellen DeGeneres, a massive thing. You know, spent loads of money. How do you think they're going about this this rollout, and you know, how do you feel about it right now?
I want them to succeed. I really do. But I must admit, I find their pitch a bit odd, a bit weird. I mean, you know, we've talked about this quite a lot in the past, and you know, especially around the whole aspect of music discovery and kind of, you know, I think I've said a few times before that I think. Really, most people just want to hear some music, and the right. You know, the sad fact is that, you know, the majority of people are just kind of want a good stream of music. They're not so fussed necessarily about these kind of very granular mechanisms to control what they discover and things like that, which I think is why radio, you know, certainly in the UK, radio is, you know, is absolutely the kingmaker and is the thing that can, you know, reaches that many people. It still has a huge effect. And in the States, I think the pickup of more radio-based services, whether it was the success of Sirius initially or Pandora now, you know, sorts of things, all suggest that really people, you know, my view is people are probably just wanting some music, and they're, you know, they don't want to think that hard about what they get. And I think, you know, the things that Beats are pushing, like this kind of slightly weird, you know, wordy thing about, you know, I want to listen to something jaunty while I'm rowing through Venice in the rain or whatever, you know, it's just sort of
the Mad Lib.
Yeah, it's, you know, it's just like, you know, I don't go running towards that thinking, oh my god, I've got to give that a go. I'm just sort of looking at it thinking, really?
Yeah. Like,
it's kind of, so I think the reason I find it odd is because it's slightly at odds with the rest of the advertising and positioning. You know, they've obviously spent a lot of money getting Ellen involved, and you know, that whole ad was sort of involving her and was quite kind of light in tone and all these things. And yet it's, you know, it's Beats, and you know, they maintain that there's this, you know, what they call prosumer sort of tier of market, you know, of the person who likes good quality things and all of that stuff. But I think the other thorn in their side is that while they're sort of doing this with a 1 week free trial, you know, Spotify and RDO promptly dumped all of the fees around access, you know, and said, look, if you want to listen, you know, if you're on a tablet, and God knows that, you know, there's a lot of kids now waving around, you know, Nexus 7s and, you know, with the cheaper tablets that are flooding the market, you know, and they've all got access to it when it's free. So I just worry about who they're talking to and how much those people are going to make a decision to use Beats when really at the end of the day, you know, the couple of sort of big exclusive acts notwithstanding, you know, these services are all fairly on, you know, on the same level. You know, the catalog is pretty much identical for all of them. The feature sets are just sort of how much you care, really. But I think in terms of which way people swing, I would imagine the number one factor will be, you know, price and things like that. And at that point at the moment, you know, Spotify are certainly appealing to the person that likes a bit of radio more, because they're sort of saying, well, you can have it with ads. And that's basically a radio experience anyway. So, you know, a radio experience with a bit more choice sounds pretty good to me for nothing. and in the face of that, you know, I just think Beats will struggle. And, you know, and the sort of grandiose gestures of, you know, blowing $4 million or whatever it was on the ad thing just made me kind of sit there and think, well, you know, are we meant to be impressed by that? I don't know. Like, I've seen no mention of a surge in signups post Super Bowl or anything else. It's, I find it all a bit odd.
Yeah, again, it was another advert though where they didn't really explain what Beats does. It was a very nicely done advert, but it didn't really explain the service, which I guess makes sense because it's an entertainment advert for the Super Bowl. So I guess whether it's a cornerstone piece of an awareness campaign that's going to be ongoing for the rest of the year, and that sort of lays the sort of the grounds for that conversation going forward. But I don't think that based on the advert, people would go, oh yeah, Beats is, of course, is a new streaming service that I'm going to be able to sign up to and all that kind of stuff. It wasn't clear.
Everything about it is just a bit sort of muddled, you know, waving around Trent Reznor and saying, well, he's our creative director. And, you know, we pay artists very well, or we pay the rights holders and the indies get all this stuff. But that's fantastic if, like us, you know, you're involved in the music business. But the man in the street has sort of, you know, over decades of piracy, has kind of proven that he doesn't really care a great deal about those things. You know, it's not high on Joe Public's agenda to feel good that they're supporting a more ethical service, you know. And so I just find it all a bit confused. I would like it to succeed. I mean, I think it's amazing that they're paying the same rates and they haven't tried to kind of screw over the indies and things like that. That is totally admirable. And they've got some really good people there.
Yeah,
but
sure.
I just find it a slightly odd pitch.
And Castelia, I want to take your hear your thoughts on a couple of things. First of all, how the hell did they manage to get majors to come on board with the same rate for everybody? Because that's certainly must have been a tough conversation. And so what do you think about that? And also, what do you think about the AT&T partnership on that front?
No pressure, Castelia.
Right. Well, I can't speak directly to how they got the major labels on board, but I would suspect that having Jimmy at the head doesn't hurt in terms of getting Universal on board. And as we've now learned, if Universal's on board, it doesn't take too much to get the other folks to fall in line. Just building on what Darren was saying, I think that what Beats is really going for here to answer the question about the AT&T is a bundled play. And that's where they're really distinguishing themselves from Spotify. And I think that AT&T is only the beginning. My impression is that the reason that the Ellen DeGeneres commercials kind of was like it was, and we might agree, it's kind of a family-friendly commercial, not only because it was done during the Super Bowl, but there's like the Three Little Bears, and we had Daddy's music, and we had Mommy's music, right? And that's not an accident, right? They want families of four or five who have AT&T accounts. It's $15 a month for up to five people to be on the service. So while it's not free, it's practically free. You know, it's as close to free as you can get if you get five people on there. And I think what Beats is making a bet on is not the freeloading teenagers with their tablets who want free, you know, service where they take an app to. They want the families who don't care about an extra $15 a month on their phone bill, which is already several hundred dollars for the kids and their texts and whatnot. To get on these services, they're really making a bundling play. So, you know, AT&T for now, but once they've got Verizon and Sprint and T-Mobile and so forth, an extra $15 on everyone's, account. I wouldn't be surprised to even see individuals eventually just kind of getting on there and you want to throw $15, that's like tax, you know, fine. Then I have Beats on my phone and it seems like it's free to me because I'm paying a phone bill, I'm not paying a Beats bill. You know, I remember when I was doing digital strategy, a big part of this whole bundling thing was because no one would know they were paying it, right? That's the beauty of the fees. So there's like a music fee, but it's part of the phone bill. And if you have any sort of qualm with it, you feel like you have a qualm with AT&T, not with Beats, right? And I think that that's the big bundling play. So, you know, I think that they're going for families and they're going for bundling. They want people to be maybe paying for these services without even realizing that they're paying for them.
Yeah. Yeah, Kareem, what are your thoughts on Beats and the strategy and their marketing so far?
Yeah, I think what Cristelia just said is really, really interesting, especially about the family plan. I mean, because that delivers a nice message about music as well, doesn't it? It does actually make the cost seem much lower, and it delivers a message as, you know, music is for the family, it's for everyone, we're opening it up here. Netflix have done interesting stuff with that as well, which has brought a lot of people on board, as far as I understand. I wonder, I've just been thinking, is what we're talking about at odds with their basic brand strength? That's interesting to me, because what I was going to give a nod to, perhaps, is Beats, you know, let's not forget, it does have that cool image to do with the ambassadors and to do with the headphones and the music equipment. You know, it's got basketball players on board doing a lot of playlists, curated playlists. So, that is a strength for the service, and we shouldn't underestimate how much that appeals to the kind of cool consumers who want the trainers, who want to buy into that stuff. And, you know, we've all said that, we've all been aware from that from the beginning. But I actually asked back to you guys, what do you think? How does that fit with the Ellen advert? Does that actually go hand in hand, or does that confuse the image a little bit?
Well, I think, I mean, this is the problem, though. And I mean, you know, going back to Cristelia's point as well about bundling, you know, this has been done in the UK, and, you know, Deezer did all this, and
Audio
really
as well. Yeah,
it didn't get a huge amount of traction at all, you know, and it kicked off a huge fight with Deezer about, you know, they promptly claimed that they had X many users, but when the questions were asked about how many were kind of actively using the service, everyone suddenly went quiet, you know, because you were bundling it in. But, you know, when it is a bundle such that you literally just get it for free because you're paying your regular way, then I think what you're seeing is that people are getting it, but they're not valuing it because it's just coming with the service. But equally elsewhere, you know, you're then seeing people not wanting to pay as much as, you know, £5 extra a month for this stuff because they just don't value music that much. You know, that's the sad reality of it, is we've reached that point where people kind of grumble. You know, I sit around my friends and we all feel a bit sad about the fact that at some point charging, you know, paying £10 a month for access to damn near all the music ever made is apparently too much. You know, and people like me, you know, when I used to work for Sony Music, I'd pop out for lunch when I lived, you know, when I was working in Soho rather. You know, and you come back from lunch with like 60 quid's worth of vinyl under your arm because there were so many great shops. And so it's, you know, it's all very relative, but it is quite strange that, you know, I don't think the bundling is like an absolute guarantee that people will go running towards it. And I do agree with you, Kareem, that I think as something that's always said that they aim for this prosumer level, you know, if it's going to become a thing that kind of comes with a bunch of, you know, mobile bundles or whatever, then yes, I think there's a very serious risk that it could then start to devalue it. And it also raises a question that I think Mark Mulligan was the first to kind of put forward, which was like, why have they not really sought to make a real connection with the headphones? Because at the moment, it's kind of like headphones are over there and Beats Music's over here. And I'm not seeing any kind of overt attempt to push the two together, but
yeah, that would be so strong. I agree with you that would be so strong, bundling it with headphones. Or they've got the link, is what's the technology, do they does it come embedded on the new Beats Pill, the actual service, in the same way that Spotify Connect works?
Possibly, yeah.
I think that may be interesting, yeah. But it, like you say, it's interesting they haven't aligned the headphones with the service yet. I assume they might.
It's got to happen. It's got to happen. I mean, that would be silly otherwise.
And it does raise another question, what you just said, Darren, about, well, how much are people prepared to pay for music anymore, full stop? And that's something Andrea raised at the beginning as well in one of the pieces. I think it's Mark Mulligan who was saying there's much less of a spend now and he's analysed the different spends, and music is certainly getting squeezed. So I think that comes into play here as well. You know, it is sad. We used to spend so much more on music, but how much are people prepared to spend nowadays, and what's it competing with?
Yeah. It's that £5 thing. I mean, if you're saying it's $15 for the family, well, you know, equally there's things like Netflix and Love Film and all these kinds of video services that are asking similar amounts. And that's a family-wide thing because you're basically buying it for the household, if you like. Mm. You know, it's something that you'd all sit around and watch or whatever. And, you know, they're seeing good traction, but by no means like a, you know, massive uptake either. So I think we have to be a little bit careful about, you know, prices and thinking, well, if it's this much, why wouldn't you? Because weirdly, people won't. I mean, God, you know, you're in realms of literally, you know, is it music for a month or a Starbucks? And it would appear that a lot of people would prefer the cup of coffee, which is kind of sad. But
this does look back, you know. Yeah, and this does link back as well to the principle of wallet share as well. There was a PRS study that I think tracked music's percentage of the spend of each person, you know, of wallet share, and it's just basically been decreasing steadily for many, many, many years. And that is one thing that streaming can bring back to the table. You know, it can anchor music back in our wallets. As long as it does get to this scale, it's that. I think that's a very important thing that it can achieve eventually.
No, absolutely. And also, I think there's a very different scale of spend between the US and the UK. As Christella was pointing out, I think in the US, carriers and also cable companies have managed to keep prices very high up until now, both of broadband and of cable access. So as she was saying, you know, for a family of four or five, it could easily be like $300-$400 a month spent on cable and mobile bills and whatever. So $15 is actually really not that much. In the UK, I think we have a different pricing structure now for this sort of thing, unless you're a Sky subscriber, heavy-handed on sports, and you spend maybe like £80-£90 a month on getting the full package from Sky. But, you know, we're still not talking anywhere near as much as what it costs in the US to get a similar type of coverage. So I guess, you know, in the monetary sense, maybe in the US it's less painful than it is in the UK to add a $15 charge to the bill. But that's maybe just my 2 cents in it. And
or $15.
$15, whatever. Yeah. And you know, we're talking about bundling. One thing that was interesting this week was actually Spotify launched a bundling in with the Sunday Times and the Times. So it's a from what they've said, it's the first partnership of this kind. They've essentially, if you subscribe to the Sunday Times or the Times for a year, which I think it starts the cheapest subscription just for the Sunday Times is about £300 a year, so somewhere around those lines. You get a free premium Spotify subscription for the year as well, included in that. So some people have compared it to, like, you know, the free radio that you used to get in the 90s when you subscribed to a paper for the year, or, you know, the free gift that you got, and now it's Spotify. But of course, the value is interesting because the value of a subscription is £120 here in the UK, which both lowers the perceived amount that you're spending on the Times subscription, and it perhaps will get more Times subscribers to adopt Spotify as their streaming service of choice without really having to do anything about it. And then perhaps if the deal expires next year, they will actually start paying for it because they got addicted to it or they saw it as good value. So, yeah, I wonder if that's going to be like something that Spotify pursues more in terms of deals. And if we're going to see more magazines and newspapers tie in with streaming services like we've seen with carriers. So, Karim, do you think that might be the case and we might see more of that?
Yeah, I think it is. I think we're looking at different distribution points, and I think it's a really interesting deal. I mean, I actually consider it myself because you get access online to the paywall content, yeah, and you get free Spotify. So, but I think the most important thing is what you said. It's just that, it's that stamp, it's that space in people's minds, it's the eyeballs on the Spotify logo and the fact that it's there. So it's just getting people used to what Spotify is and bringing them into that world. I think we will see more stuff like that. I think people in all territories are looking at all sorts of flexible deals like this. You know, Deezer has one with one of the local radio stations in Spain, for example, and that's to help you know, get people to know Deezer via the radio station channel, and it'll help the channel with information about what people are listening to help it put stuff on its you know, on the air playlist. So yeah, services are looking at partnerships all across the board. And I think for newspapers, this stuff is really interesting because they are treading very new ground as well, you know, losing print readers and looking at how to transition online and getting people to pay. And yeah, so if you can bundle this kind of thing with it, it's very attractive.
Yeah. Cristalia, in the US especially, you know, the print industry is really struggling in newspapers. Do you think that we could see a New York Times plus Spotify subscription, a bundling of those two?
Certainly possible. What I think is sort of the most interesting angle here is that, you know, my take on this is that this is a play to bring in a different demographic, right? So the current mm-hmm. Spotify user is, you know, people who are music people, and then it's young people who are, you know, tech savvy and early adapter type folks, and then some passive listeners whose friends told them to do it, but it's not my mom and my dad, and it's certainly not my grandma, but those are the types of people, or my neighbor or someone's teacher at school. Those are the people who will be subscribing to the newspapers, right? And so they may be exposed to Spotify in a way that they never would have sought out on their own, but since it was given to them, they check it out, and this is a chance to say, hey, you know, older folks, less tech savvy folks, check us out. It's free. You know, maybe you have a year to figure out how it works, and if you decide you like it, then you can stick with it. So I like it. I'd love to see more bundles of this sort. You know, I had a little bit of an initial hesitation for these types of bundles where you're paying for the newspaper and you're getting the music for free. My question was, well, this just reinforces that music is free. This mm. price tag on music is still zero, and the newspaper costs whatever it costs. And then when the year ends, are people going to be willing to pay for something that they now think of as being free? But, you know, I think, you know, I've had enough people, I think, try to convince me that this is, you know, this is not so different from, you know, people giving you a free coconut water. It doesn't mean you think you're never going to have to buy it again. It just gives you a chance to try it out. A full year is a really long time to try something out. But, you know, maybe they figure this is the best way to really get in a demographic who otherwise are simply not going to do it. And they maybe need more than a free month to figure it out, or 7 days if you're in Beat's case, to figure out if you like something or not. I think it's a really nice way to reach a different demographic.
Yeah, it makes sense, like what you said about trying to educate people as well. Like, one of the big keys into the success of this program is going to be whether the Times does enough education with their readership to allow people that might not necessarily know what Spotify is or how it works to actually get into it, because that's really the key barrier to getting people to adopt something is to actually get them to try it out for the first time. And so that's going to be the key.
Yeah. Yeah. Because I imagine if you tell my uncle, like, hey, you got a free Spotify subscription, he has no idea what that means or what to do with it. So there's going to have to be a little bit more, and you know, I'm sure Spotify is on this, but there's going to need to be a little bit more literature and or follow up with the folks who get this so that they can actually make use of it.
Yeah. Yeah, sure.
I think that's really interesting. I hadn't thought about it in that way yet as well, and the fact that the Times demographic might be slightly different to, let's say, your Guardian demographic. Mm-hmm. The interesting thing about the year period is Rob Wells, I think, a while back said that there was a 6-month inflection point when you become so embedded in a service that you start to feel it's essential. You know, you've got all your playlists, you're used to it. So then I suppose the year gives people 2 or 3 months to understand what it is first, get drawn in, and then start creating the playlists. And so they need that whole year upsell them.
Yeah, absolutely. Well, that's going to be quite fun to see what happens with that, and if we're going to see more deals of this kind coming in. And I wanted to just quickly cover Shuffler. So Darren Shuffler has just launched a new app, a magazine called Pause, if I'm not mistaken. And it's an iPad app. It's a magazine that's going to come out quarterly. It boils down essentially the best of the best. The first edition is on 2013's best music and artists releases compilations, all sorts of stuff essentially, and it ties in with the Shuffler FM's radio, and you can do all sorts of stuff with it. They also announced a partnership with Sonos now, so you can actually access Shuffler.fm via your Sonos device, which is a great win for them, because it means that more people are going to be able to access to it, especially the ones that are choosing Sonos as their system of choice in the home. So yeah, lots of stuff happening there. You know, how do you like the app?
I haven't used the app. I've had like Steve O'Reilly and Tim and all the guys sort of telling me very excitedly about the app. Unfortunately, it's an iPad app, and I only have an iPad 1, so it's getting no love from me. I mean, I'm sure it's great. I mean, you know, I'm a huge fan of Shuffler. You know, big fan of Tim in particular. I think he's a smart guy, you know, and with Stephen on board now, you know, they've got, you know, a really good little team together there in terms of, you know, you won't beat them for enthusiasm. You know what I mean? Yeah. They're really super passionate. So, yeah, I mean, I must confess, haven't tried it. Think the idea is brilliant. My one sort of marketing comment was that I kind of wish they hadn't have launched it with a retrospective, because it's February now and retrospectives sort of a more December, very early January type thing. Small complaint, frankly, because I think from here on, you know, they'll continue to churn out good stuff. But yeah. But I have to say, for me, the big news, because my house is entirely sort of Sonos driven at the moment, is their arrival on there, which is absolutely awesome. And it's weird because it made me realize something a little bit pathetic but quite interesting, which is that, you know, when these services latch into something like Sonos, which I use, and I mean, Sonos isn't the only thing in my house. We have, you know, hi-fi, and you know, typically, I suppose, given what I do for a living, there's sort of no end of ways to play music in this place. But it's interesting when something like Shuffler lands on Sonos, because you just find yourself using it so much more, because the reality is that day to day I use Sonos for the bulk of my listening, you know. Right. It's what's, you know, it's what's on in my office all the time, and so it's permanently on, and they've got a really nice sweet spot there in that, you know, you have a million music services you can plug in, whether it's Spotify, RDO, take your pick, you know, they're all the same really. Then you get, you know, you've got Hype Machine as well, which is very good at rounding up kind of the best music from the blogs and things like that, which is kind of what I use it for on Sonos. Yeah. You tend to gravitate to the sort of chart end of it. Whereas Shuffler gives you a really kind of cool way of either digging through, you know, charts of most popular things and stuff like that, but more on the kind of radio side, where you can just pick a genre and have it, you know, play things. But it's also worth noting that the way they've integrated it is very smart, because the radio experiences on Sonos from the likes of RDO just show you what's currently playing, but they don't sort of show you what's being played, and they don't show what's coming out. So basically, they don't work with the playlist system that kind of drives Sonos. Like, if you play an album on Sonos, it creates a playlist for your album and then plays it. When it's radio, it's literally just taking one track at a time and spoon feeding them in. The Shuffler, I've noticed today, because pretty much just had to turn it off to do this. You know, it's been on all, you know, since I got up this morning. It's great because it's a bit like Google Play Music when you tell that to just play you some radio, where it's creating a kind of a never-ending playlist. But because it's all there, you can see what it played hours ago as well, you know, and you've got that option of digging back to find the songs you love. So I have to say, it's one of those, you know, really sublime matches where you're just looking at it going, this will transform, you know, Shuffler's, you know, my use of Shuffler. But I think it would also get real adoption because it's actually occupying a space. I mean, I, you know, there's American services I don't use. I'm not sure if Songs Are is on there, and obviously maybe that Pandora's bolted on and things like that. But here in the UK, where you haven't got those kind of services, it's really good, you know. And now, you know, I mean, Last.fm is there, but it's not something I've found much value in on Sonos. But Shuffler is really hitting the spot. So haven't used the magazine app, but to be honest, I feel like that's sort of pulling up second to the Sonos thing.
That's great, actually, because I'm a Sonos user. I think there's more people that would have tried the magazine app at this point, like myself, than people that would have used the Sonos thing yet. So that's great that you had that testimonial on that front. And I mean, the magazine app is really great. It works brilliantly, and you know, it's a slick experience. Lots of nice content, you know, good retrospective on 2013 from lots of cool sources. So no complaints there. It's a really nice app, and it's nicely made. So definitely looking forward to see what they're going to do for the rest of the year with that. And I guess, you know, the retrospective side of things is probably due to the development deadlines that probably got dragged through, ended up
in February. It's you know, like all the great ideas, they're very simple in their execution, and it's little things. Like I don't have time to sit and kind of obsessively read every music site out there, but the fact that Shuffler is kind of pulling together the audio that these sites are posting and then providing them, so that if you don't want to say just play me some shoegaze radio or something, you could say actually I just want to hear the music that Drowned in Sound are posting up, then it's kind of a way of listening to those sites, which is, again, it's kind of simple, but I think it's very effective, you know, and it gives you that connection. I mean, I have to say, I'm really, really impressed with it. I was a huge fan of Shuffler's apps on mobile anyway. It's one of the apps I kind of miss from switching over to Android. But, you know, that, and I think Shuffler and Discover were about the only two that I really did use to find music, because they were a very reliable way of just sort of surfacing things that you fancied. And it's sort of, it is weird that there's not many radio experiences that I'm seeing where you can sit there and say, you know what, I fancy a bit of, you know, underground hip hop, and it will just sit there and spoon up a load of it. So it's great. Cool. Love it.
Awesome. Cristalia, do you know Shuffler? I keep thinking of it as a European startup, so I just have no idea what kind of footprint they had in the States, if any.
Yeah. So I do know of it, but I think I'm probably the exception to the rule because I'm engaged in the world and a big music dork. So I know it, but it doesn't have much penetration in the States. I think there's certainly a market for it, but as is the case, no doubt in Europe, it's a niche market, right? It's folks like me who would think, oh wow, like a retrospect magazine. This is great, but there's not a lot of us. And so I think, as with most of the services that come to the U.S. market, if there's not tons of advertising to be sold around it, it's going to be slow to gain penetration. It's going to be slow to get in front of people. I didn't know that it was on Sonos now, so I'm all excited. And as soon as we're done here, I'm going to go and try to check that out and see if I can make it work. I'm with Darren. Anything that's on Sonos is going to increase my listenership considerably, because I'm going to have it on and just leave it on while I'm working. And as much as I like to think of myself as an active listener, you know, the passive listening that Sonos allows through any of the apps that are on it is really perfect when I have to do other things. So
And Karim, how do you see the future for a Shuffler at this point? You know, are they going to gain a new market share through the Sonos partnership and start expanding from that?
Yeah, I mean, I think what we're saying is what Darren and Cristelli have said is really interesting and absolutely highlights the advantages to hardware partnerships. They're still really there. I mean, I think I haven't been able to try the app. Disgracefully, I only have an iPad 1 as well, so I need to upgrade, but I'm a big fan of Shuffler. But just to draw on the hardware partnership thing, I mean, it sounds like a big advantage for them, and it reminds me of someone I know, slightly older than me, and their family all use Napster. And I said, why? When I saw them the other day, I said, you know, that's kind of unheard of in in the UK. And I said, well, how did that come about? You know, you're going to try Spotify, you're going to try Ardia or any of the others. He's like, no, you know, it came on Sonos. We love it. We use it. All our playlists are there now. And we're just going to keep using it. And so that just reminded me of that example as well. Yeah. Hardware partnerships, distribution is still very, very important. I think that's the takeaway.
Absolutely. And Cristelia, I can't let you go. I'm going to start wrapping up the show, but I can't let you go without talking about Pandora. So, you know, there's so much stuff happening in the States right now. So just to do a very quick, you know, sort of summary of what's going on for the listeners that might not have been following the story. So, you know, ASCAP and BMI essentially have both had rulings, separate rulings at the end of 2013, stating that publishers could not withdraw their digital rights from the organizations without violating the consent decree, which BMI argues is completely outdated, having been signed in 1941. So publishers like Sony TV and UMPG have that had withdrawn their digital rights from those organizations in order to do the direct deal with Pandora and other services like Pandora, now found that they had to rejoin, essentially, until maybe the consent decree is modified by the courts. And also, at the same time, there is a battle going on rates with the Pandora, also court-led. And again, ASCAP and BMI are operating in two different courtrooms separately, which is kind of bizarre because I have two different judges that are looking at this thing, and they could actually, in theory, get two different decisions on what's going to happen on that. So, you know, you're probably the only one of the four of us that can talk sensibly about this, but it's just, you know, feeling the pulse of what's happening in the States right now. Do you feel like it's just a complete mess? Or do you feel like things are getting slightly organized in the wake of this ruling at the end of 2013, and people sort of now understand, okay, no, so this is happening, this is what we have to do, this is what's going to have to happen, essentially. And at the same time, that, you know, they're going to have success in getting this consent decree changed so that the big publishers can withdraw their digital rights from the main collection organizations in the States.
So the short answer to your question is it a giant mess? Is yes.
Yeah.
Of course, it's a giant mess. You know, as
I tried to explain it, it's impossible.
So nothing's changed on that end. What I think is particularly interesting here, and just, you know, I think Andrea did a great job summarizing it, but for the viewers, effectively what's happening here is there are these consent decrees that were originally put in place to keep ASCAP and BMI from acting as monopolies, right? From, you know, this was an attempt so that they couldn't throw their weight around and you know, charge anything they wanted to the people who needed access to the content. So is the consent decree that was originally entered in 1941 outdated? Of course it is. But it's a bit disingenuous for BMI and ASCAP to suggest that it was set in 1941 and hasn't been touched then, because it is constantly updated and constantly revised and constantly monitored by the courts. The Southern District of New York, which is the rate court in charge of monitoring these all the time. What the original consent decree didn't contemplate, of course, was digital streaming services, but it didn't contemplate lots of other things either. It didn't contemplate CDs. It didn't contemplate, you know, you name it, cassette tapes for that matter. So it's not really that the agreement didn't contemplate digital streaming. What it is that what I think is really going on here is that content owners are reconsidering whether they want to do things collectively or not, right? When ASCAP and BMI came up, the thought was we need these organizations for a couple of reasons. First, because there's just too many deals to be done, and we couldn't even identify all the partners we'd have to do deals with. This gives us a one-stop shop to come and get the deals done, and it saves transaction costs. We'd have to sit down and negotiate with all these different parties. In the digital world, a couple of things have changed. First of all, it's not that hard to identify who you need, because in the digital scheme of things, players, and there's so many online outlets that make it easy to say, I need deals with X, Y, and Z.
Yeah.
In addition, because of consolidation in the industry, for better or for worse, there's not actually thousands of different deals that need to be done. It depends on the service. You know, you may be a Spotify or Beats where you think you need, you know, 4 million or 20 million songs in your catalog. But there are a lot of smaller services, maybe take Shuffler, for example, who could do a handful of deals with their particular labels and be covered. So what this whole mess is really calling into question is the value of these collectives.
Yeah.
Because if ASCAP and BMI want to withdraw their digital rights and leave their other rights, that's really them saying, we want to do our own deals.
Right.
You know, and if that's, and that's the case, then that's the case. They don't have to belong. And that's what the rate court said to them. Okay, fine. Yeah. You want to do your own deals. Take all of your, take your ball and go home. You can't, you know, take some of your toys and go home and leave the rest of your toys. You've got to gather up all off the playground. Because if you leave them in here, it's unfair to the services like Pandora and so forth, who are licensing piecemeal. Because they're, you know, first of all, they have to then turn around and renegotiate with you. And second of all, they're not getting what they thought they'd paid for. Yeah. You know, that's the real
It's quite a mess, because on the one side, you think, you know, of course, Sony ATV and UMPG want to withdraw their digital rights so they can get better rates via direct deal. And it's essentially would be in BMI's and ASCAP's best interest for them not to do that, because then they lose bargaining power when it comes to renegotiating their own rates. Because if they lost some of their primary rights holders that have the best tracks, essentially, then they're left with everything else.
Sure. On the legal side, we call this adverse selection. And all it means is that when the big, powerful guys leave, they take their big powerfulness with them. So what's left behind are all the small labels, all the mom and pops, who not only have less bargaining power now because they don't on the ATV behind them to sort of navigate this blanket license. But they're also less well-funded because these organizations run off of, you know, membership fees and a percentage of royalties collected. And when, you know, 80% of the royalties collected walk out the door, you've got a really poor organization that's toting this blanket license that's worth a lot less.
Yeah.
And this is problematic for all the guys who aren't Sony ATV.
And of course, you know, we're talking about publishing here. So just so you know, that the numbers on digital are still in the single digits when it comes to percentage of revenues for, you know, the totality of ASCAP and BMI's incomes. So that's always something to keep in mind, because, you know, they want to withdraw their rights on the digital front, but they certainly don't want to do that on all the other fronts, because ASCAP and BMI are still doing a fantastic job in collecting royalties and redistributing them to the right people. So I guess that's where Sony ATV and UMPG are in a bit of a pickle now, because looking at the future, they want to withdraw the digital rights, but looking at the present and the current hard-earned cash, then it's definitely in their interest to stay within those organizations. So
that's
very,
right.
Very interesting, very interesting. Guys, I don't know if you have any comment on that. I know it's a pretty convoluted issue, but...
but no.
Okay, cool.
That's it's a deep topic, right?
Awesome.
It's,
yeah, exactly.
I think you've covered it perfectly well, guys. Shut the hell up and there you get on with that one.
Awesome. Well, you know, I think I'll wrap it up here. I just want to mention to listeners to go and check out the Tiny Tempa app, his wrap app, which is really cool. And it was made by some of our friends at We Make Awesome Shit. It's doing really well. Lots of GIFs and videos and viral things being shared with everybody supporting their Tiny Tempa mouth. So definitely go and check it out in the App Store. And that's pretty much it. Well, if you want to plug anything at all, I'll start with Cristelia. On your end, if people want to find out more about you, where should they go?
You can go to cristelia.com. cristelia.com. If you are a songwriter or a recording artist, I would particularly love to hear from you. I'm doing a survey right now to get artists' opinions on the copyright laws and the changes that they'd like to see. So if you're interested in participating, we'll make a donation to Little Kids Rock, and your input will be really helpful in shaping the congressional hearings that are coming up.
That's fantastic. And Kareem, on your end?
Well, just, please check out musicallo.com. That's musicallyoneword.com. Follow us on Twitter. Have a look at the blog. Our new report comes out today. So check that out. There's a lead on brands and music and digital platforms. Apart from that, thank you very much. It's great to be on the show.
That's awesome. And Darren, for you, it's multimanone.com. Anything else?
No, I mean, I think there's so many things going on at the moment, there's not enough time to mention it all. But
that's great.
I mean, actually, I suppose, the PR hasn't run yet, but obviously Motive Unknown has now got Lucy Blair on board.
Yay.
And Lucy's joined to help me dominate the world one campaign at a time. So, we haven't kind of PR'd that yet. It's not a secret either. We just, you know, to be honest, I think we're both too busy to stop and figure out the PR bit. But, Lucy's on board. I'm really pleased. It's taken me over a year to snag Lucy onto the team. So I'm super, super pleased.
That's great.
And, yeah, so that's the... the thing I want to mention. Perfect. I think all the other things can probably wait till next time.
Awesome. That's great. Well, thanks so much again for taking the time to come on the show. It was fantastic having you on. And thanks so much for listening to DMT. The show comes out every Wednesday. There's also a DMT one-to-one show, which comes out every week with individual interviews with startups and interesting digital marketing projects. And that's pretty much it. Thanks so much for listening. Have a fantastic week. And till next time.